This episode has been brought to you by Worldwide Soba, a Japanese noodle production company.
This week on Meat and Three, we get ready for Super Tuesday by looking at how food shapes elections both at home and abroad.
People know that you don't order a Philly cheesesteak with Swiss cheese as John Kerry did back in the 2004 cycle.
A young group of friends decided that they would put up a website which told voters which polling booths had sausages.
Prime Minister David Cameron was pictured about a week after this incident eating a hot dog in a bun with a knife and fork because he was so afraid.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. I was recently in Florida at the Naples Winter Wine Festival, benefiting the Naples Children and Education Foundation. I had an opportunity to sit down with two legendary Burgundy producers, Laurent Ponceau and Erwin Favoli. Enjoy. Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey on the Heritage Radio Network. We are at the Naples Winter Wine Festival, benefiting the Naples Children and Education Foundation. Our guest is Laurent Ponceau. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Laurent.
Thank
I'm
you.
Very excited to have you here. I've drank a lot of your wines, which is always nice. And I followed you, and there are a lot of interesting things going on, and I want to talk to them about you. So let's focus on the present and the future, mm-hmm. which is an exciting time for you. You left the family winery.
I did.
Three years ago. 2017. Domaine Poncet, after how many years?
36.
36 years to start your own winery.
That's it.
Kind of an interesting story. And the winery is called Laurent Ponceau.
Yep.
And you're doing something very fun and rewarding. You're with your son, Clement, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Give me a brief evolution or a history. We talked about 3 years ago you left, so I said let's talk about the present and the future.
Yep.
Why did you want to do this, and you know how did it come about?
Well, first of all, I left the family estate by personal reason. I have personal reasons that I don't want to develop now. But the thing is that when I was free to do what I wanted, I had two options. Retire. I was 63 years old.
Not ready.
It's not my thing. So I'm going to die minimum at 102, so I have some time to live. So I decided to restart with my children. Actually, my three children are not involved, but two of them are just in the shareholders, but one, my elder son, is joining me to restart. And I decided to, from a vigneron, to become a négociant, but négociant haute couture. It means...
So you're now not just a vine grower, you're not just a winemaker, you are something you haven't been, and that's a négociant, right?
Yes.
So explain, so everybody knows, what a négociant...
For sure. I think we have to break the codes. You know, everything is... stuck in the mud for...
Especially in Burgundy.
Especially in Burgundy, you know. And I wanted to think that the future is now. You were speaking of present and future. My present was the three last years to grow, to restart, to establish something. And now, this is why I'm here as well, because I can also help the charity with some wines. I had no wines my oldest
so
vintage.
The question, why are you here? You want to be here because it's a good cause, but you also have the wines.
I mean, you have to
show up here with wine.
I can just show off myself,
right. Bring wine.
Yeah, sure. And being a négociant haute couture has a big meaning. Burgundy, as you know, has 1,200 different appellations. Each appellation is shared between a lot of owners. So each one, let's take an example, Corton Charlemagne. You have 52 hectares and you have, I don't know how many, maybe 70 owners.
Wow.
Each one is doing his own wine. What I wanted to do is to blend the provenance, the grapes coming from every part of the Corton Charlemagne.
Which
from Pernod Vergelais.
Which you couldn't do when
no.
you were you can, your own.
Even if you own some place in the Corton Charlemagne, you cannot do that. Because you have the village of La Douai-Sérigny, Alos Corton, and Pernod Vergelais. This is the only place in Burgundy that is facing east, south, and west. So if you have just one part of the ground, you make one type of Corton Charlemagne. I wanted to make a universal Corton Charlemagne. So being a négociant haute couture allow you to purchase grapes or most from a lot of winemakers. Actually, I have six providers for the Corton Charlemagne, and I pretend that I produce the only universal Corton Charlemagne. I don't say the best, I don't say it's good or whatever, but it's coming from everywhere. So this is what
it's a different wine.
Do. It's a different wine.
It's, you know, it's a négociant wine. It's
négociant wine has
a stigma.
Stigma. And I want to put the négociant, the name négociant, as a noble name, because if Burgundy is well known for centuries, it's only due to négociant, because the estate bottling in Burgundy started in the mid 70s, not before. Before the Second World War, 10
right.
familial estates were doing the bottling themselves. Only 10 out of 3,500. So let's go back to what the négociants made in the past, and they still do. I mean, many great négociants are doing the same job. I mean, Fevlet, for example, is a perfect example of a négociant. You cannot say they have to separate their two estate and négociants, but they could blend as well. This is what I say. Let's break the codes. I own vineyards. I farm myself. But if I farm, for example, Griot Chambertin, I can buy grapes from my neighbor and blend it. So
I said we'd stay in the present and the future.
Yeah.
But if you go back, is it a fair observation to say that it could be frustrating to not be able to do that? Like you have a bigger palette or canvas?
It's not frustrating because you are doing your work. You do the best where you are with the tools you have.
Right.
You have to just to go a little further. This is why when I said I was free to do what I wanted, I said, okay, let's do this. Okay, so I could also purchase vineyards and do things like this. But I don't want me to be named a vigneron anymore. I pretend being a négociant. And when I say haute couture, it's because every single detail in fashion, for example, is important. The button, the raw material.
The way you look at a piece of designer clothing is the way you're going to view the wine.
So
you know,
for
every
the wine,
detail.
It is the same. And the raw material is essential. You know?
All right, so I asked you to give me an evolution. So the first thing is you become a négociant, and that gives you the opportunity to go to different areas. Okay, so now what are we doing? You have your own vineyards, I think you said, and you have the opportunity wherever you could find, you know, grapes that you want.
Yes.
So what happens now? You're ready to make wine.
No, I didn't. I did make wine.
Actually. Yeah, no, I know. I'm not
but
saying.
I'm ready. I am just a week ago. We started to build a brand new winery, a big winery, because I have already some.
What were
some
you place. Doing before that?
Well, I have some place, but it's already very narrow and too small. So we are building a new winery.
Where? Côte Saint-Louis?
In close to Vougeot, in Gilly-les-Citeaux, which is down in the plain, below the main vineyards of Burgundy.
That's necessary, right? In
it
order
is.
For you to make the wines that you want to make,
with
you need
precision.
To have your facility and control.
We have to be precise, absolutely precise,
right.
In each phase of the winemaking process,
right.
And aging.
So tell me about the properties, first of all. How much wine are you making from your properties? How much négociant?
I would not answer to that. I am a négociant because I purchased the grapes from my other company.
It wasn't the right question. You're right. The way
because
you
I don't want to be anymore. Like to make a separate idea for people between my own vineyards and the vineyards I buy the grapes from. Everything is the same for me. See, so
that's the philosophy of this winery.
So I have now 26 appellations already. In 3 years, I worked like crazy. I started with six only, and I have 26 today, including 12 Grand Cru. So I think I am very proud of this. I am probably one of the, if not the only one, a rare guy in Burgundy to produce 12 Grand Cru out of the 33 existing. So it took me a while, but...
So trickle that down for me. So let's talk about the wines and how many wines you're making. I mean, there's a big discussion with this because it's your label now. The look is different.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, all of that. So how many wines are you making?
26 different appellations.
It is 26?
26 at the moment. I don't want to grow too much. What I want today is go to maybe another 2 or 3 if I have opportunities, you see.
So acquisition, expansion, you're pretty much where you want to be. Your vision is to stay a certain size.
To stay at a certain size where we can control everything.
Right.
My son, my chef de cave, my cellar master, and myself. We don't want to be too big,
right.
See. It's, again, haute couture.
Right. That.
But we have sometimes only one barrel. For example, I produce a Batard Montrachet. I have one barrel per year. But this is a typical Batard Montrachet. It's not a beverage made from Chardonnay and oak. See, this is it.
Is it fair to say, I mean, in that example, it defies the question I'm asking, but is it fair to say you're trying to make Burgundy or some Burgundies more accessible?
I do too, yes, for sure. I just said I have 12 Grand Cru in my portfolio,
right,
but I also started to produce Bourgogne Blanc and Bourgogne Rouge, the starting level of Burgundy. And I do a lot of this now because the demand is there. And I also produce village wines, which are more accessible.
So there's village and then Bourguignon?
You have the Bourgogne, then you have village,
yeah, right.
You have the premier cru and the top,
the
crème
de
la crème, you have the grand cru. So I produce all of these these different appellations to have some wine accessible everywhere on the planet.
So that gives you the opportunity as a négociant.
Yeah.
To make, and you can make as much as you want depending on.
Sure, but the problem is to find the good raw material. And I pretend that out of 3,500 winemakers, vine growers in Burgundy, many of them are doing a great job. How can I pretend I am the only one to produce good grapes?
Right.
People are doing the same or even better. So I have to chase these people and
I'm
make
sure
a deal
you've
with them.
Had relationships.
And I have,
but
for sure.
They don't have availability or
yeah, well,
they're contracted to someone else.
Believe me, some people, I was amazed how people were nice to me when I left Domaine Ponceau. Some people came to me and said, do you want, for example, the Batard Montrachet? Someone came to me saying, okay, I can provide you every year enough moss to make one barrel. Are you okay?
You know why they asked you.
Because
they would rather have it in your hands than other people.
No.
Yes.
Yeah, maybe.
Yes.
I don't know.
But that's
in
part
the meantime,
of the
it was nice to me. I didn't.
Yes.
I didn't want to make a better.
So that was a good start.
It was good.
You
start.
Know, the door knocks. Like,
yeah,
hey, you want
yeah.
some of my
well,
good wine?
But it's not always the case. Sometimes you have to knock on doors.
Yeah. No, I'm sure. Talk to me about the packaging. You wanted to make it a little less traditional. The labeling
hate,
and all that
yeah.
is very fun and very interesting.
I hate the word tradition.
This is radio, so you have to describe
yeah,
it,
yeah,
theater
yeah.
of the mind.
Well, first of all, I mean, again, we are living in the 21st century, so why would we take the Middle Age as an example? See, no, my packaging is now, the labels are like...
neon.
Formula One Mercedes, you know, gray,
right.
Flashy, and, but sober in the meantime. See, and there is a little green writing on it to remember that nature is at the origin of everything. So the green is nature, is the color of the tiny leaves of the vines. So I am confident that nature is at the origin of everything. So I want to pay credit to Mother Nature anytime. But the look of my cases is my cases are made from composite, you know, not anymore wood or whatever. We have foam in the cases, which is the first time in Burgundy people is using foam. In Champagne, they know how to make packaging. In Burgundy, I don't know why we are so late.
So it's more late and clueless than cheap or anything?
No,
just didn't.
It's not cheaper.
No, I know it's not cheaper. Right.
It's not cheap. No,
but they just
high level.
They didn't come up to the times.
No,
They weren't. And it's so funny because it's amongst the most valuable wines. Why wouldn't it be in the best packaging?
Because it's valuable, I protect the wines as well. Each capsule of the Grand Cru has a chip. And you just put your cell phone on the top of the neck and you get the proof of authenticity, even if you don't have the app.
So that, it's fairly unique. And you're doing that. And there's a reason why you're doing that. I mean, there's been a lot of forgery in Burgundy, you know, at the Grand Cru level and all that. Why do you feel that you want to put a chip on? I mean, what does that do for you and the consumer?
Well, first of all, the fact that some people made fake wines in the past or still today, I don't know, I cannot stand it. You know, it's just a question of principle. I don't want people to dirt the spirit of the wine. As I said, Burgundy is very rich in diversity. Why would you produce, just because you need money, a wine which doesn't correspond to what is written on the label? So this I cannot stand. But when I started to protect my wines, it was not only the reason. The reason is that these are expensive wines. When you purchase it, you want to be sure that it is the genuine wine, coming from the place it was supposed to be coming from. And so technology of today can help for that.
Right. It makes it easier for you.
It makes it easy. So I am in the future. When I said future is now, this is not just a talk. It's real.
Right.
I mean, I always was progressive. I was the first to have a website in 1989.
Wow.
I did it myself, you know.
Stay up late nights.
Yeah, it was 9 years before Google existed.
Right.
See?
Isn't that amazing?
It's amazing.
Still in its infancy.
Yeah.
But that was a very early jump.
Yeah.
You know, you had the foresight and patience.
This is why I said, look around what we are doing. Tradition is not a good word. History is a good word. Let's take in the history, everything that was good, and eliminate the mistakes. Our ancestors made mistakes because they didn't have the right tool to protect the wine against becoming vinegar or whatever. So today we have it. Let's use it. And if it doesn't exist, we are ready to invent it.
And listen, we talked about this before the show. We could do a whole show on it. I mean, Burgundy fell under a forgery scandal, and you were very much, you know, part of that in the best of ways. And like I said, that's a whole separate story. So obviously there's a sensitivity. Without getting into it, do we still think there's a lot of forged Burgundy out there? Do you think things have quieted down or stopped because of certain individuals, or it's still a good business?
No, it's a small business.
It is.
It became,
that's encouraging.
It became today one person in his kitchen doing something.
Literally.
You know, literally. But the guy we talk about, the Rudy Kirner one, didn't do that. He has been trapped because at the end he was forced to do that in his kitchen. But before that he had a big lab with helpers. How come he made $10 million per year?
So the real story is, if you read the story or look at the movie, you say, "Oh, the guy was making counterfeit."
No.
He was a much bigger operation.
Sure.
Right. How many?
How come he makes $10 million per year during 10 years?
Right.
It makes a lot of bottles. It takes 1 hour to fake a bottle. Calculate how many hours he would have worked. He was not alone to make it, for sure.
How many 1945 Romani Contis are left? They just kept coming, right?
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
It's just a crazy thing.
Sure. No, but this is another part of my life when I was an FBI guy. But,
I encourage my listeners, to look into Laurent Ponceau and his impact on the, you know, Burgundy's forgery scandal. You know, like I said, that's the whole thing. And that's not why I brought you on. As far as all that. But when you brought the chip up, that's a sensitivity and reacting with the technology to doing the right thing and all of that. You talked about building a winery. When's it going to be ready?
Well, I think I will make wine in this winery in 21.
So this is 20s, your last year, not making it under your own facility.
Yeah, but it will be the same kind of wine. Be capable to produce a little more.
I think
more.
You know by now what you want to do.
Yeah.
You said something about the bottle. About the green being nature.
Yeah.
You have a different perspective on what are very buzzy words now, which are biodynamics and organics. I think we all believe in protecting the environment and, you know, creating a problem. To you, they're labels, or what's your take on?
Well, wine is made on Earth for around 8,000 years. Okay, during a, I would say 100 years ago or even less, 80 years ago, we started to spray with a lot of bad elements. In the past too, I mean, previously they used copper and sulfur to spray on the vineyards, which is natural, but...
But I guess you could say after World War II,
yeah,
that was a...
Exactly.
Why did people, you know, fall into doing that?
Because people came in the wineries selling these bloody powders, and they wanted to make money. You know, I don't say any name, but the company that was producing
like, here's
it,
an easy fix to your disease or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, for sure, because it was working for nope. for the corn, for whatever. They say, oh, there is maybe a market with the winemaker. So they did it.
That's 40 years.
It was the
50s. Kind of killing the...
Yeah. And so the reaction of human beings when they discover they made a mistake is always excessive, I guess.
Right.
See, and when excessive is to create a name, to put a name on a new discovery. They discovered nature existed. I'm sorry, but nature makes the wine for 8,000 years. So my opinion, and it was the same with my family, we always stayed close to nature. We never used any bad chemicals. And no, I don't want to have a label on my head.
That was always
like
your sensibility in your practice.
It was.
That's in your mind. That was the way to do it.
It was
to do.
And but
historically, too.
Yeah, but
done.
In the meantime, I am a human being. I am healthy. I have a healthy life. But if I have a big problem and the doctor says take this pill, if you don't take it, you're gonna die. I will take the pill. I don't want to know what is in the pill.
So you equate that to the vineyard.
I am ready. If we have another phylloxera coming somehow. To use all the weapons we can have to save the vineyards.
But that's...
But I don't need...
That's
today.
Catastrophic. You know, phylloxera is a big deal.
Yeah.
So I hope you're alluding to that doesn't happen often, if
no.
not recently, so you're really not taking the pill to get better. You
exactly.
don't have to... So that's a good thing.
It's a good thing.
Right.
But I'm
but
ready
in,
to do
in
it
practicing if that, you don't have to no. be Demeter certified or organic.
No, I don't
or whatever.
Want that. I don't want that. What is the most important is the wine which is in the glass when you are drinking it. Whatever the guy made, if the wine is outstanding, it's outstanding. And on top of it, I will not say that badly, but today the chemicals used by people which are still using chemicals are so soft that when the grapes get into the winery, there is nothing left because the industry, the chemical industry, they don't want to kill themselves, you know, to get to commit
right.
suicide. So all the products that my colleagues are using are soft enough that during the harvest there is nothing left. So this is never said in the meantime. So, okay, if you can avoid using them, better. And it's not easy.
But are you saying that by them being soft, they're using them, which isn't necessarily good, but kind of goes away?
Oh yeah, sure.
But
sure. It has an effect.
So why do it at all?
No, because
they have to. They feel
it's easy when you have
right.
an attack of oidium, for example,
right.
to spray immediately with the chemical, but it will stop the pandemic.
You had mentioned that before.
And that's it. But well, you can do another way, which we do too.
You talk about wine in the glass. I'm curious, when you started making the Laurent Ponceau wines, is there any similarity to your other wines? Is it an opportunity to totally break away? Do you take the best practices? You know, is it, can somebody drink it and say, oh, that's Ponceau? I mean, I know. I mean, what's the opportunity you have
well,
to how you make the wine?
I am the same guy. So
of course.
I didn't change
but
anything.
My question is, what
no.
do you do? The same guy does what now?
He does the same.
Okay.
He protected Mother Nature, take the best of Mother Nature, do his best. You know, in the process of winemaking, from the roots of the vine to the glass of wine, it's a chain. And we are vine growers or winemaker, we are just a part of the chain.
Right.
Our role is not to break it, and it's a big responsibility. But nothing else. We are not, movie stars or whatever, like some pretend being. We are just there, and we have to stay humble. So I am the same guy, humble. I give me all the tools to go into that direction, to propose to the final drinker, I don't say customer, but drinker,
right.
the authenticity of the terroir of Burgundy. If I have one appellation, as I mentioned the Cordon Charlemagne, but Gruyère Chambertin, for example, because this is one of my main wine, this is a Gruyère Chambertin. It's not, I mean, a beverage made from Pinot Noir and, I don't know, and manipulation and things. That's it.
It's interesting.
It's simple, but
I know
it has to be said.
I know, but I think people would be curious, you know, after making wine for so many years and, you know, making a new wine, you know, what the differentiation is. But you answered that, you know, eloquently. Before you came in, we were talking outside, and I want to ask you two quick questions. The first being, why are you at the festival here, the Naples Wine Festival? And then I want you to talk about you're coming back to New York. Not that we're in Florida, but you're going back to New York for an award. So first, why is it important, or why are you here?
Well, I came the first time here for the 10th anniversary. And since I came several times already, so when it happened that they asked me to come for the 20th, I didn't think about it. I said yes, for sure. Because I knew I would have wine, because with no
right.
wine, I'm not here.
Right.
To support, I mean, the cause, I mean, the charity, you need to have something to offer to people. Okay, I can offer a day with me and a big dinner
right.
in Burgundy.
But there's got to be wine somewhere
that
in the configuration,
sure,
right?
Sure.
Yeah.
So this is what I did it, because I like this cause. You know, here in Naples, we are always asked to give bottles for charity, and we cannot do. I mean, we could give all the bottles if we say. But here, I found the first time, and I came the first time already for that, it's a real cause, and 100% of the funds are going to real purpose. And this is what I like. And I'm not home here, but I know a lot of people as well. So it's fun to be nice to people in this kind of conditions, you see.
Yeah, it is a good cause, and the people that are behind it make sure that virtually all the money goes.
Sure.
And yesterday we visited a bunch of kids, and you see the money in action.
Yeah.
And it's very heartwarming. Then the other thing I wanted to ask you is, you're receiving a fairly significant award overall in wine, you know, top of the list. What is that?
Well, you know, there is a big brotherhood in Burgundy whose name is Confrérie des Chevaliers du Tatevin. So they have 2,600 members in America.
In America?
Yeah. 12,000 members all over the planet.
Around the country.
2,600 in America. So the
and does America act as their own chapter or organization?
Yeah,
even though
yeah.
it's part of one, they...
Yeah, well, okay. we I mean, it's controlled by the headquarters of Burgundy.
Regulations, codes,
they
and all
are,
that.
They are free to do what they want. And every year since a while, the New York chapter is giving an award to someone, and they call it the Tasse de Vin d'Or. So I'm this year the honoree, so I'm very...
First time?
First time, but... Yeah, first time. Because
what
you
took
get
them
it only
so long?
Once in your life.
Oh, okay. I still don't know what took them so long.
No. I don't know, but, you know.
Well, congratulations on that.
I don't know if I worth it, but...
No.
I'm gonna fly.
Come on. You know, we talked about, you know, 36, 40 years doing this, you know, with the utmost of attention to quality and, you know, the environment and all that. It's a well-deserved award, and congratulations
Thank
for
Thank
that. I'm always curious when I sit with guys like you, when you're not tasting your wines, what are you drinking? What do you like?
Well, I am really open-minded. In my private cellar, 80% of the wine standing there are from other countries.
All over the place,
all
I'm guessing.
Over the planet, including wine from England. Well, they lay
sparkling.
Down as long as my great-grandchildren will open it. Maybe, I don't know. But yeah,
So you're inquisitive?
Yeah, a lot.
And you're not, well, I love wines from Tuscany. You can't box it in.
No.
There are so many great wine
my
regions,
my sensibility
right?
goes more to Barolos, to South Rhone wines. But
Those are Burgundy versions of their region. Barolo
yeah.
more than Tuscany, Southern Rhone more than the muscular Northern
maybe
Rhones,
not,
right?
It's not maybe the reason, but for example, in America, what I like to drink are Zinfandels. Why not? These are wines that people doesn't know really. The other day, we made a horizontal tasting of 15 different Zinfandels from the same maker, same vintage. There were 15 different wines. And I was amazed.
Same wine,
that.
15 vintages.
Yes.
Would you say who it is?
Turley.
It was Turley. And it was the one vintage? You know, they
one
make
vintage.
They no, but they make so many label designates.
Yeah.
It was the same wine of each vintage.
No, it was the same vintage.
Same vintage.
But 15 different locations.
That was my question. I couldn't get the question out. Yeah, yeah. So there was a Pacente and all that, whatever, all that, but the same vintage year.
It was amazing.
Was the variation crazy?
Crazy.
Like from not velvety one smooth
yeah.
to a little more higher alcohol
exactly,
to...
Yeah. That's a sunny one, more mineral. And Zinfandel is, for me, the American grape, even if it came from Italy.
Turley is certainly one of the better and more interesting producers. I mean, Paul Draper makes terrific Zinfandels. So that's an interesting take. You're open to drinking everything, and then when you have an opportunity to drink through.
For sure. And, you know, I ride my motorcycle across your country, the USA, every year. And
Do you make the time and a trip to do that?
I own one Harley here in America that I leave in a friend's garage, and I go from a friend's garage to another friend's garage every year.
So and you take weeks off, it sounds
yeah,
like.
Yeah, this year we made 4,000 miles.
Jesus, only. Long. That's great.
And each time when we stop, we go to the spa and we have a bottle of Zinfandel. That's it. Yeah. Sometimes a cigar.
When in Rome. nothing wrong with a good cigar. Have you done that through Europe? Have you motorcycled?
Yeah, no.
It's easier here.
Motorbiking in Europe is too dangerous nowadays.
So this will be my last question, and then we have to wrap up. So it's not a bad thing to get on a Harley on a beautiful day, drive across the country, open up a great bottle of Zinfandel, maybe crack a Dominican or a Cuban cigar, relax, go to sleep, repeat.
That's, you know, before being a winemaker or a négociant, I'm a human being. And I like the life. I mean, life is short.
Let's feel the time
you are on this planet the best you can.
Very well said, and we'll end on that. Good luck with your wine.
Thank you.
If people want to know more about it, certainly they can go to the website, and then let's talk about where or how.
Yeah, well, we worked so hard to establish everything that we forgot to do any communication. So I just started a month ago with an agency to make a lot of things. So the website is not yet finished, but we are working on it. Within a month, I think it will be published.
But I guess if you go Google Laurent Ponceau, when it's ready, that'll pop up. What about a social media presence?
Exactly. We are there for...
On Instagram?
Instagram
and
Facebook for a month already.
Okay. What's the Instagram site?
It's a good question. I don't know.
It's not Laurent Ponceau?
It's Laurent Ponceau, SAS, I guess.
Okay. You know what? If you go to the search bar, it'll bring up the
current, which is the way to do it. But my people are doing it, so...
All right, Laurent,
good.
I really appreciate you taking time. You know, when you come down here, you're busy doing dinners and tastings, and the auction is about to start. It was very insightful talking about your new winery and sort of a new chapter in your life.
Sure.
It's very exciting, you know, when you're old guys like us and you get a shot, it re-energizes you.
Exactly.
So that's
you feel much younger.
Absolutely. Having your son by your side is a wonderful thing. So good luck with all of that. I want to thank Laurent Ponceau from his eponymous wine label. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people.
This episode has been brought to you by Worldwide Soba, a Japanese noodle production company. Founded by Shuichi Kotani, Worldwide Soba offers noodle consulting services in addition to supplying a variety of tools for wannabe noodle makers. Want to take a class? Worldwide Soba has it. Need a traditional Japanese soba knife? Worldwide Soba has that too. To learn more, visit worldwide-soba.com.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Erwin Favoli. How do you pronounce?
Erwin Favoli.
Okay, I'll never say that.
Morning, Sam.
Thank you for coming. Welcome to The Grape Nation. Erwin, you are a seventh generation winemaker.
That's right.
And there's been a generational change in wine through the years, mm-hmm. and you took over the family business. It's been a few years. What was that, back in 2004?
15 years, that's right, exactly.
Okay, from your dad, Francois, right? Yeah. Give me a quick history of the domain. We don't have to get too far into the weeds or go too far back, but you know, people know the brand, they may not know the history.
So that all started in 1825. Back then, just to give you an idea, in 1825, that was 30 years after the French Revolution. Napoleon passed away 4 years before. And in Nuit Saint-Georges in Burgundy, my great grandfather was a shoemaker. He was making clogs. And I believe he had this dream or this idea to make wine. Actually, to make great wine. So he began to trade, to do a little bit of trading of wine. Then we know that he began to buy grapes, a few investments, a few vats, etc. Turned those grapes into wine, and he was certainly much more gifted to make wine than shoes. Because I've never seen any Fevelet shoes.
Okay.
His
legacy is the wine, not the shoe.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah, and then I would say his philosophy was that it's very if you have the aim to make extraordinary wines, it's very complicated, even if impossible, to rely on someone else to sell his fruits. So he began to buy vineyards, and seven generations later we are today one of the largest, but not only one of the largest, but one of the primest landowners in Burgundy, with 12 Grand Crus, many Premier Crus,
right,
in top vineyards. And now this so today we are still a negotiant, meaning we are still buying roughly 20% of the wines we do are coming from grapes we buy, but the vast majority of the wine we produce are coming from our own
significant holdings.
That's right.
Like you said, compared to... I think you'd be the guy to help our listeners with this. There's no region like Burgundy,
mm-hmm.
as far as the way it's set up with, you know, appellations and plots of land and all that and families. Just... quickly explain to my listeners, you know, why Burgundy, as far as what property you own or where you grow wines, not so much the region. And you're in the thick of that because of your size and you're in a lot of regions.
In fact, I'm not going into minute details, but Burgundy today is the result of nearly 2,000 years of winemaking. And today we are, so as I said, we are the result of this very, very strong and rich history, and over those 2,000 years of history, what have we discovered in Burgundy is that first, Burgundy makes great wine, but Burgundy especially was not only made great wines, and that's why Burgundy until the French Revolution belonged only to the king, the nobility, or the church, but also we realized that only two great varietals were outperforming. Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. So Burgundy, we call it the cradle of those two great varietals. And then all this identification of the top vineyards of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay over this centuries, those centuries and centuries and centuries, have came up to what it is today. Meaning that today we know what the great vineyards are. We call them Grand Crus. They were classified as Grand Crus. We know where the very good vineyards are, but not to the standards of Grand Cru. Those are called Premier Crus. And since all those vineyards had been around for centuries and centuries and centuries, and until the French Revolution belonged only to one property, and then after the French Revolution began to be split up, today Burgundy is very interesting because in the same vineyard, tiny vineyard, we are talking about 10, 20 acres, it's not uncommon to have 10, 15, 20 50 different owners.
Right, that's the uniqueness.
It's very unique.
I wanted you to go there. No, there's no other place like that.
And you know, when we buy or sell vineyards, because that happens quite often, when we, the unit that we talk in Burgundy is called an ouvré, and an ouvré is roughly a tenth of an acre. That gives you an idea about how tiny the plots we are working on.
And why did it come to that? I mean, you just explained that a piece of property can have multiple owners. Was that through history, families, breaking up?
Yes, absolutely. And as I said, you know, the top vineyards have been identified for centuries. And therefore, when those vineyards were confiscated and then sold after the French Revolution, everybody who was making wine wanted to have a part of what was the best. And therefore, those vineyards, a few were never splitted, like Romane Conti was never splitted. But
we call that a monopole?
A monopole, that's right. Let's take, for example, Chambertin. Le Chambertin is roughly 10 hectares, so 20 acres. And today in the Chambertin, you would have more than 20 people having owning a piece, because everyone wants to own a piece of this, because the wine you make in Chambertin is extraordinary.
You have to be there.
But if you want to make the greatest wines, it's both the beauty but also the limit of Burgundy, is that no matter how talented you are as a winemaker, in Burgundy, if you don't have access to the top vineyards, you will never be able to make extraordinary wines. You will be limited by your vineyards.
Right.
And in Burgundy, it's we are talking about a reality, because those vineyards have been identified for, as I said, centuries and centuries and centuries.
I want to talk about your wines, but while we're on the subject, I mean, do you have a fear? I mean, do you think Burgundy has become too pricey to some extent, you know, unavailable? It falls into collectors, the secondary market, whether it's auction or whatever.
It's a concern.
Is that good for business?
It's a concern. Of course, it's good for business. Now, the reality is that if you look at prices at the domain, prices have gone up, but it's really the market that has multiplied the prices.
But that's a touch point for a lot of people.
Yeah.
They don't see it unless it's at that level.
The amount of value which is kept by distribution is quite high. But I mean, that's the way it is, and that's the way it works. And we are fine now. To come back on your question. It's a concern, but we should not. All the top wines, the Grand Crus and the best Premier Crus, it's true, can become extremely, extremely pricey. Yet, we are talking about just 3% of Burgundy.
Right.
Burgundy is still. I would say 90% of Burgundy is composed of village wines and regional wines.
So let's.
And over there, you have some very, very strong. Very good
you
values.
You have the property, you have the winemakers, you have
extremely
the wineries.
Good.
So let's talk about that. Uh-huh. So then a new generation of wine drinkers that want to drink Burgundy don't have to get caught up in the Premier and the Grand.
No.
So you alluded to it and expand a little more on it. The place to go is Bourguignon, village level. I mean, talk to me about what those wines are.
But
you just said it's 97-98% of the, you know.
Exactly. Everybody knows Romane Conti, everybody knows like those names, but at the end of the day, Burgundy has been back in 1935, in order to help the consumer to understand the appellations in Burgundy, we came up with this pyramid middle classification, where on top of the pyramid you have the Grand Crus, you have 33 of them. Great, small, tiny vineyards. Those vineyards I was talking about, that everybody want a piece of it. But then at the base of the, then you have the premier cruise, you have what we call the village. So village what we call village, it would be a vineyard that is in a village and good enough to be able to have the name of the village attached to the climat. And then you have the last level of that pyramid is called Bourgogne, Bourgogne Rouge. So the only thing you know is that the grapes, if you have a bottle in front of you and you read the label, it just states Bourgogne. That means that the grapes are coming from Burgundy. And
but all the great makers are making Bourguignon and Village.
A lot of them. Not all of them, but a lot of them. For example, for us, we are for us the this entry level. This entry-level appellation, Bourgogne Rouge and Bourgogne Blanc, would represent nearly 25% of our production, and here we are talking about wines that on a restaurant list in New York, in New York or in a restaurant, on a restaurant list, that would be the price point would be somewhere between 30 to $45.
So great price point. Accessible.
It's a very good price. It's a very good price point, and you'd be surprised how good they can be, those wines.
What about? I agree, and I think because people are interested in Burgundy, they either wind up with that or get pointed to it because of availability and cost. Mm. What about ageability with those wines? I know you wouldn't lay them down for 20, 30 years, but no. Is there a benefit to get a...
Of course.
To put it down 3, 5, 6, 7?
Yes, of course. You always have a benefit to lay down your wines. The reality is that when you buy a wine that's $20 for a bottle, you will pop the cork. The probability you will pop the cork within the few hours is just like now. So, of course, it would benefit the vast majority, if not all, the people would not do that. But I would. The better the wine, so the Grand Cruze and Premier Cruze, yes. Even though we know a fair amount is consumed right away, those wines, you would be surprised how those wines can age and how those wines get incredible with age.
Burgundy is, you know, Burgundy, Bordeaux are just great wines in their next levels.
We have, you said that, we talked about that at the beginning, but I'm the seventh generation to run the domain, so we have quite an extensive library at the domain.
Well, let's talk about that.
Yeah. So we have, talking about ageability, we have wines from the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, and from time to time we pop a cork from
and they're
from
all.
You still have bottle variation because, like, but if you're lucky because if you're lucky, you get. If the bottle has been well preserved, the cork has been well preserved, the wine
provenance
is extraordinary. Awesome. It can be extraordinary.
Let's talk about the wines and let's talk about you.
Uh-huh.
We talked about how you jumped in there in 2004 and you're pretty much running the place, but there are some changes. You know, I think, you know, in doing some research, 2007, 2012 were important years. My take was that stylistically,
yep,
you made changes. I think you looked at what your dad was making and said, think I want to make a different wine. Talk to me about that.
But my father was has always loved wines that were powerful, quite big, quite tannic.
That doesn't seem to be the typical Burgundy.
Not today. Come on. My father made wine. Run the winery. He started in 75, so he was also, you know, the trend of the 80s and 90s.
Like Napa in the 80s, and we're making big wines.
Everyone.
That's how you did it then.
That's right. And in fact, even though that was exactly what he wanted, and especially he wanted also to make wines that would age extremely well. And his belief, and I think he, to some extent he was right, is that you could, if you want to have a wine that ages well, you need to have quite some backbone and therefore quite some extraction.
That's not the end all, though. You could do it otherwise, right?
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
And then, you know, when I took over my father in 05, the reality is that trend was over. And people, and especially in Burgundy, where Pinot Noir, a lot of people realize that Pinot Noir, I think its best expression for Pinot Noir is drinkability, softness, silkiness. And that was the direction I wanted to take. So for 2 years, the first 2 years from 05 and 05 to 07, every week I would visit a winery, one of my colleagues. I would not say competitors because we are...
You're in it together.
We are in together. And I was quite surprised how welcoming all those winemakers were. So I visited a lot of wineries, tasted a lot of wine, talking with them how... what in their process they would do, both in the winery and in the vineyards, what in the process they would do that would ended up in the wine I was tasting.
Because and everyone was not making wines.
I know.
People were making the wines you're making now then, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's why when you went to talk to people, you would see that type of wine.
But not that. I visited... dozens and dozens and dozens of domains, identifying the style I liked, the style I wanted to I wanted to do, and also identifying the style I didn't like, and by talking with them, I also identified what we at Fevlet in our processes would lead to the wines my father was making, and what therefore I would need to change.
So that was like a two-year research road trip,
exactly.
Tasting, and it came together?
And it came together in 07, because in 07 we've changed quite a few things at the winery.
The 07 vintage?
Yeah.
You were able to express the changes?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, and so at the winery, in terms of vinification, I think I was lucky, certainly the luck of beginners, because... I believe the 07 we've done are superb. And, first, I think it was one of the most undervalued, underrated.
Not like vintage. An 09 or something.
What a vintage.
You love
07,
it.
07 res.
If you see 07s.
Not everywhere. Not right. Everywhere, but for example, I tasted... Last Tuesday, 5 days ago, I tasted a wine, an 07 from Groffier as well. The wine was
great,
incredible. And therefore, you talk about 2012. 2012 was also for me a milestone, because changing things at the winery. I wouldn't say it's easy, but it's you just do the investment, and overnight you can change your vinification process. When you decide to change things in the vineyards, it takes much more time to express. And for me, 2012 was the first vintage where, if I look back, at some point I would have told myself I would not have done something different.
That's good.
Yeah. I think so, and ever since, it's quite nice, because you. Alors, of course, from time to time, for example, in 2015, a great vintage. I think I'm not so sure I would have done. Whole cluster maceration. I think 15 didn't.
So your philosophy on whole cluster and destemming varies by the fruit, the vintage.
The
it's
vintage.
Not a set philosophy.
No.
You know.
Not at all. And what I've really learned in 15 also as well is that this technique is very much not only vintage. Based on vintage, but also it's very correlated to the terroirs and to villages. For example, Chambol-Musigny
right.
is great. Vaune-Romanée is great. Gevrey-Chambertin is not a place where I would where I would do it.
It varies.
Yeah,
you have to react to. It's a good segue, and it's a tough question, but you're almost unique in size. I mean, how many different wines are you making?
I would say around 80.
That's what I counted. Yeah. And the major properties are like Gevrey-Chambertin and...
Alors, the where we have the most of our vineyards, first
that's
is
the question.
Côte Chalonnaise in Mercurey. Mercurey, we have roughly 50 hectares. Then Gevrey-Chambertin, where we have nearly 25 hectares. Nuit Saint-Georges, we are quite strong there.
Those are the... Yep. And then,
and then we have we have small plots spread all over Burgundy. We have small plots in Chambolle, in Clos Vougeot, in Puligny-Montrachet, etc., etc.
Is acquisition something you always have your eye on in Burgundy? If a piece of property, not everyone can afford to acquire, but if you have the resources and you know something,
that's the thing. You know, I'm not looking to expand because I'm very happy the way I am. And also, as you said, price can be extra. The prices for the top wines, and
it's blown up finally.
Yeah. And to be honest, if I grow, I would if I buy a vineyard today, considering the size we have and what we have, it would be only something exceptional, exceptional
right.
things.
Something you can't pass
are so expensive.
Right. And the nice thing, I mean, we talked about Burgundy being pricey, mm-hmm. not available. You make so many wines. I mean, you see them; they're available at better wine stores. They're on every restaurant list. There's every level. Aren't you one of the largest holders of Grand Cru vineyards?
No. We were talking about Romane Conti. No, Romane Conti, they have 25 Grand Crus. Enfin, not only Romane Conti. Romane Conti is just 1.5 out of the 25. We, in terms of Grand Cru, we have a little more than 12 hectares, which is very sizable.
Right.
It's quite sizable.
Right. Erwin, we have to wrap up.
Uh-huh.
I told you it would go fast. I want to thank Erwin Faveli from Domaine Faveli, in a good way, for Burgundy. The wines are somewhat ubiquitous.
Mm.
You know, you can go to a restaurant and see them on the list. Like I said, you can go to a good store. You talked about 80 different wines, so there's certainly, a variety of sites and prices and all mm-hmm. of that, and that's a nice thing. Just quickly, why do you come down to the wine festival? Have you been here before?
That's my third edition, and because it's fun, because I think all the profits goes to charity,
right?
And that's this is very unique. This is
your
very
chance to give back.
It's yeah, exactly. So it's you have the Florida sun, the charity.
Can't complain about that.
A nice atmosphere. Like, can't complain. Yeah.
All right, everyone. Thank you.
I'm glad
you're down here.
Thank you, Sam.
It was very enlightening. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation on Heritage Radio. We bring wine to the people. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.